Today I'm talking with Paul Herman, who is the CEO and co-founder of Hip Investor, and also the author of a new book, The Hip Investor: Make Bigger Profits by Building a Better World. Paul's been crisscrossing the country on a book tour and consulting projects, and I'm thrilled to be able to speak with him today. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Olivia.
The Hip Investor, your company, you advise investors, companies, and entrepreneurs to realize human impact plus profit, which is the HIP acronym. And you do this through different scorecards and measurements. Now you have a book that is helping to bring this methodology to regular investors like myself or other people out there, as well as for businesses. So first, lead us off. What makes a HIP investor?
Okay, well, a HIP investor, and HIP does stand for Human Impact Plus Profit. A HIP investor is somebody who seeks to both do good as well as make money. And this is distinctive from traditional socially responsible investing, where you might have to sacrifice returns in order to get that positive human, social, or environmental impact. And so what we do at HIP Investor is merge the worlds, the best of socially responsible investing and the best of traditional investing that pretty consistently makes money, and to integrate those two together into a world of HIP investing. And what HIP investors do is they seek out, across all their investment opportunities, public stocks, mutual funds and ETFs, their venture capital and private equity, if they're high net worth investors, their fixed income and bonds and cash, they look for the highest potential returns as well as the highest potential good in all their investments. And that could be in bank accounts like, you know, New Resource Bank or Wainwright Bank or Shore Bank. It could be in mutual funds like Portfolio 21, that's performed over a long period of time. And they can essentially, you know, look at and monitor and evaluate their HIP score over time.
So, and the idea is that you really can do well, make investments that are responsible, and have them profit. And before, you know, I had this idea that social responsible investments did actually outperform traditional investments, but maybe that was mistaken. Is that just incorrect, or is it there a long-term profit, but I could, if I'm looking at social responsible investments, I don't get the short-term gain?
Yeah, let me explain that a little bit, and also let me just, you know, state, since this is a recording that'll be replayed, that, you know, HIP is a registered investment advisor, and we're registered in California and Illinois, and the discussion that we have around particular investments or approaches is for information and education and not an investment recommendation. You know, how does socially responsible investing compare to traditional investing? In general, in up markets, traditional investing really outperforms socially responsible investing. That when you take a socially SRI approach, socially responsible investing approach, that focuses on negative screening and you kick out companies that are perceived negative or have products that have negative impacts, and you just kick them out of your investment universe, it actually increases the risk of your portfolio and has tended to depress the return. The second thing that happens in socially responsible investing is the people who do it focus on policy evaluations and operating practices and filing proxies. And all of those things are helpful to know how a company thinks and operates, but they don't actually correlate with better financial performance. And so the approach that we take, that, you know, we think takes the best of both worlds, is we focus on quantifiable results. So what is the true outcomes in the categories of health and wealth and earth and equality and trust, which are inspired by Maslow's hierarchy of needs? And what and how do those drive new financial value? And we do that for all companies. And so we give companies who are even on this negative screen list a chance to improve. And so when you do that, you find that sustainability factors, the results, the metrics of results, actually drive financial performance in a way that beats traditional investing in up markets and down. So in down markets, SRI approaches do tend to be traditional investing, so they're better on the downside, but they don't really keep pace on the upside, so if you hold it over a long period of time, it tends not to do as well. Mm-hmm. Now, one more fact around this is even though most SRI funds or ETFs don't keep pace, a similar amount of traditional funds or ETFs don't keep pace as well. So, you know, 80 to 90% of mutual fund managers, through their strategies, are not able to keep pace with the index. So how we address that from HIP is we've created the index. We've created a HIP 100 index, and there'll be other indexes forthcoming, where you get maximum where you get diversification, and you get a compelling return as well as appropriate risk.
I just want to back up for a minute and talk about your experiences. You have worked for organizations that myself and many of the listeners of this podcast would envy. Aminyar Network and Ashoka, and you're a member of Investors Circle. You also have an MBA from Wharton. So you have this interesting combination of social enterprise and serious financial background. So how did you develop the HIP methodology, and what set you on track to begin thinking this way?
Well, just to clarify, I have an undergraduate finance degree, an economics degree from Wharton, not an MBA, and I actually don't have an MBA at all. I got MBA equivalent experience by working at McKinsey, which is a business consultancy.
I find that very refreshing.
and also, you know, entrepreneurial experience. So HIP Investor is the second company that I've started. The first created an online debit card for kids, teens, and parents. That was a type of a social enterprise. And so, you know, I think what many of your, you know, listeners to this podcast, you know, may, you know, find a potential, you know, direction for their career. I mean, I was really inspired early in my career by a man by the name of John Sawhill. And John Sawhill was former head of the Nature Conservancy, former partner at McKinsey, former head of president of NYU University, and ran the Superfund for President Carter. And to me, that was a very complete career. It crossed sectors, business, social, government, academia. And it really, you know, provides a view of how society really operates, which is cross-sector and cross-industry. And so that was inspiring to me, and that's why I sort of started in business, moved to social, have blended them together. You know, I do some teaching and lecturing, including at the, you know, not only at MBA and graduate schools, but in green MBAs. So that's, you know, really, you know, motivating to me to understand how the world works across sectors, and then to, you know, come into industries like the finance industry and introduce a new way of thinking that, you know, to this day, you know, hasn't been very prevalent, and to help set a new standard in terms of being a trustworthy financial advisor and financial institution that can also be transparent. So that's why we've, you know, put together the book where we're open sourcing about 3/4 of the HIP methodology.
That's interesting. So how did you develop your methodology?
So the methodology came about was actually, you know, through a combination of business and social experience. And so I was at Ashoka, and you know, Ashoka is a nonprofit that supports social entrepreneurs in scores of countries around the world. And the supporters of Ashoka, the donors to Ashoka, are self-made business entrepreneurs. You know, 3/4 of them are, of the money comes from self-made business entrepreneurs like Pierre Omidyar, Jeff Skoll, Craig McCullough. And so in talking with entrepreneurs, they said, I get a great social impact out of my nonprofit donation to Ashoka. How do I get that up from my for-profit portfolio? And so I said, okay, well, let me go find you some for-profit examples and bring them back to you. So I went to the Microfinance Information Exchange, the MIX.org, and brought a couple examples back. And the entrepreneur said, that's great. Go run them by my financial advisor. And when I got to the financial advisor, you can guess what they said. They said, no, we're not going to do this. Now, this is interesting because microfinance deals, you know, the underlying fundamentals of microfinance are loans from a financial institution, a microfinance institution, to low-income people who essentially invest in themselves as entrepreneurs and end up having a 95%, 98%, 99% repayment rate. Now, when you look at credit card repayment rates, They're nowhere near 95, 98, 99%, especially among subprime customers like low-income people. And so here you have a low-risk, higher-return approach that ends up having a lot of social benefits to it. And because it has those social benefits, traditionally trained financial fiduciaries and investment advisors confuse that with not being an attractive investment. And so people like Muhammad Yunus and Al Gore have won Nobel Prizes for their work in showcasing how social and environmentally driven organizations and investment opportunities can actually be profitable. And these aren't Nobel Prizes for economics, these are Nobel Peace Prizes, because it removes the conditions under which violence can exist. And that's, you know, that was the reason, one of the supporting reasons for Muhammad Yunus and the Grameen Bank. And Al Gore raising awareness of all the environmental risks and, slow going on environmental opportunities that investors, you know, haven't taken fully advantage of. So that's how HIP came about. And so, you know, human impact plus profit was a memorable way to describe both the approach and that, you know, people tend to have a hard time forgetting, you know, are you a HIP investor and are you HIP? And, and that's how we built out health and wealth and earth and equality and trust into the factors that support a more HIP portfolio. So, and we really drive this home, to make this a real people-based approach. So usually when I talk to groups of people, I'll say, you know, how many of you have heard a company say, people are our most important asset? And most people raise their hand because companies say that all the time, and then a few giggle because they know that something's coming. And my next question is, where are people on the financial statements? And the reality is that under the generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP, people are costs on the income statement and liabilities on the balance sheet. They are not assets or typically seen as revenue generators on the financial statements. And this is a breakdown in our measurement and management systems that companies use every day. So the concept for HIP that we sometimes talk about is, if you know the UN's Human Development Index, that's a way to quantify economic, social, and environmental measures of a country's performance. And HIP is basically, the HIP scorecard is a human development index for company performance. And when companies start to compete on human, social, and environmental metrics that are leading indicators of financial performance, we can help accelerate the world to building a better world where investors have the opportunity to make bigger profits.
There's different indicators within the five categories that you mentioned: earth, equality, trust, health, and wealth. You have about 20 indicators that you use to evaluate companies or investments. Is that correct?
Yeah, it actually stretches to about 30. We describe, 20 of them in the book.
Okay.
And we also describe the management practices that a company makes decisions around and the products and services that they sell. So we wrap all that together into a HIP score. And the companies that are more HIP get a higher weight in the index, and the companies that are have a lower HIP score get a lower weight. And when you build that together as a portfolio, that's where you can get a HIP index that can outperform the S&P, the HIP 100 and the S&P 100, on average by about 4% or 400 basis points in finance language.
So,
now, the interesting thing is this has been showcased in different ways by Wharton professor Alex Edmonds, who showed that companies that are the best companies to work for that have been published in Fortune magazine also outperform the market by about 4%. And companies with a high proportion of women on the board of directors also tend to outperform the ones who have fewer women on the board of directors by about 4%. And so Wall Street is ignoring that, and traditional investors are ignoring that these are leading indicators that are fully accessible. You know, it's free information to collect this data, but they're not embedding it in their everyday pricing of stock portfolios. And so that's what we're trying to showcase, is that the best companies embrace a more sustainable approach, a really systematic view to looking over the long term and comprehensively, that value all talent, that put a price on the environment, on its cost and its opportunity of working in it, and that if you do so, you can be a more HIP investor.
You know, I was reading that the HIP index values measurable results over policies and philosophies. And oftentimes when people hear about social responsible business or sustainability, there is an emotional component. They think it's an emotional judgment or a moral judgment. Do you weight these moral or emotional drivers or decisions, or is it completely measurable objectives?
Well, first of all, we should clarify that even making financial projections, that any CFO or analyst or business manager who makes financial projections is a subjective process. So whether you put in 4% growth or 6% growth for your company, you know, that's a judgment call. So on the metrics themselves, I mean, we are looking at real resources, people, air and water, equality, distribution of diversity. We're looking at real numbers of environmental, social, and human aspects that may not always be as easy to count as a stack of money, but they are countable. Just because it's difficult doesn't mean that it's not meaningful or that it's not possible. And when you do that, and you put together a comprehensive model about how the world works, which is, you know, people create ideas on which they then companies, you know, put products together that they sell to customers. Employee services customers, and when employees do that really well, customers come back because they like being served well. That in order to make those products or sometimes services, you need to use natural resources. And that the whole process by which you do that and make decisions about how you invest the company's financial, natural, and human resources ends up leading to a, you know, outcome that can be quite compelling. So this whole objective versus subjective is, you know, the reason why economics and science exist are to help quantify things that we haven't yet come up with a good system for. And what we're trying to do at Hip Investor is to show that it's not only real, it's quantifiable, and it can be more systematic. And the model, of course, has to evolve over time. It's, you know, the model we have today will not be the same model in 5 years. It will evolve forward. But it's a better model than the historical model. And we want people to think long-term, and to think comprehensively, and to be inclusive. And that when you do that, and you build a quantitative model around it, you can help companies run better and strengthen your portfolio.
So how can companies adopt a HIP approach? Is it through using the scorecard? I'm sure that's one element. And what are some other tactics that they could use or frameworks that they could apply?
Okay, so this is a great question. And public companies, you know, companies of any size can do this. Both early stage companies building off of an initial idea, and large public companies, in the top 10 of the HIP 100 index include Procter & Gamble, General Electric, and Intel. All right, so step number one is to create products and services that customers want and that can be healthy for them. So GE has a, you know, Eco-Imagination program. There's 80 different products that are in it, everything from wind turbines to compact fluorescent light bulbs to eco-efficient locomotives. And those products, those 80 products, cumulate to about $17 billion in the year 2008, and that's about 10% of GE's top line. So from R&D lab to how companies pick what products and services they sell, companies can be more hip. Pepsi has an approach called Good For You, Better For You, Fun For You, where they classify 30% of their food and beverage revenues, which include Tropicana orange juice, Quaker Oats oatmeal, Naked Juice smoothies, into the good and better for you category, whereas the fun for you might have, you know, potato chips or chocolate chip cookies. And then a third example, which is really transformational, and Dave Stengis, who left Intel's CSR group and moved over to Campbell Soup, has helped to work with the CEO Doug Conant on this, is they actually draw their revenue pie not only on geography and product lines, but on how many milligrams of sodium per serving are in their products. And they're trying to shift their whole revenue based on milligrams of salt in the soup products, which are, you know, things that many of us eat every week, like tomato soup, chicken noodle soup, and creamy mushroom. So that's the first step. The first step is really build products and services and sell products and services that customers want that create health or wealth or earth or equality or trust. And the second category is, how do you run your business? And so we see, you know, a variety of different operating metrics. You can draw from the catalog of 30 that we've pulled together, and we describe 20 in the book, that focus on things as simple as customer satisfaction, employee satisfaction, greenhouse gas intensity, water efficiency, board and executive team diversity, trust and certifications. So when you go and look at these numbers and you map them directly to the financial statements, and it, sometimes it's not easy because, as we've described before, people are not found on the financial statements. There is an exception to this. So Infosys, the technology company, global technology company based in India, actually puts together a balance sheet with people as an asset. If you search for human resource valuation in Infosys' annual report from 2007, 2008, or 2009, you can find it. And it basically shows that the more you invest in people, then you can generate higher return on assets, where assets actually include the people, not just the tables, chairs, and computers, but the actual intellectual capital inside the company. So companies who build a balanced scorecard of metrics that aren't just financial, that include customer and employee, environmental or social, and run their company like that. So Starbucks does that across six different categories. McDonald's has a criteria that does. Walmart has developed a supply chain scorecard for its suppliers that cover environmental and social criteria. That's a second way that companies can manage themselves. And then the third component is, how do you build this into all of your decision processes? Mm-hmm. Your capital spending process, your performance review process, we talked about R&D. You know, how do you actually accumulate the numbers inside the company financially, socially, and environmentally? And the companies who do, and Alcoa is a company who does this, they make aluminum that you find in your soda can or in your car frame. And Alcoa, in addition to having metrics that cut across environmental, social, and financial, also have a decision process where early in the stage of making any capital investment, they will do a, quote, triple bottom line analysis. So they will look at financial, social, and environmental data for a $5, $10, $50 million investment. They will run that through a decision process, and then they will either adjust the project or approve or deny it based on its performance. This is an S&P 100 company in a very asset-intensive, energy-intensive, mm-hmm. dirty industry that is using triple bottom line analysis that you can find on their website at alcoa.com/sustainability. And so companies can actually do this. They can build products and services that customers want that are healthier for them. They can manage their business in a more comprehensive way by looking just beyond, by looking beyond purely financial data. And they can change everyday decisions from the products that they make, the capital that they allocate, the performance reviews. So General Electric will not issue a full bonus to a manager who hits their financials but misses their greenhouse gas reduction target.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it's actually doable for companies. Mm-hmm. It's not impossible. And, you know, we describe a lot of case studies across the whole S&P 500 in the HIP Investor book.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Dave Stangis, who's now with Campbell's, and he's been, you know, getting a bit of attention lately for some of Campbell's projects around social responsibility. And he said that HIP changed the way that he thinks about business and its impacts. And he challenges people to ask themselves, what's the quantifiable impact of their work and why aren't they measuring it up front? So have you worked with him directly? And if so, could you talk a little bit about, and this is kind of hard because it's talking on his behalf, but about how your methodology or your conversations help reframe his thinking around sustainability?
So Dave and I have known each other since about 2007 when we did the first HIP scorecard in Fast Company magazine. And it was at that time when, you know, we connected with each other, we had a discussion on the phone, and he said, which, you know, we talk about in the book, you know, this shifts my whole way of thinking. It focuses on results and impacts and outcomes, and we actually have to be accountable and measure what we do. And, you know, and he was on that track anyway, but it really, the HIP scorecard crystallized it for him. because he said, you know, there's some things on here that we hadn't considered before. We hadn't, you know, necessarily looked at all the health impacts. We've looked at some of them. We hadn't looked at all the wealth impacts. We've looked at some. We, you know, we've done a pretty comprehensive job of Earth and equality at Intel. But it really expanded his thinking. And so we haven't worked directly together on a project, but we have, you know, kept up our relationship, and I just saw him a few weeks ago in Philadelphia. And, you know, in coming to Campbell's, he has grafted into the business strategy, which the CEO was very interested. That's one of the reasons he was recruited away from Intel, sustainability. And to do that for the thousands of Campbell's employees and the millions of Campbell's customers, and to really accelerate this push to greater health, because when you cut sodium out of a canned soup, it's actually, you know, has the health equivalent of increasing your exercise. Now, of course, you should still exercise. It's not a substitute. But it's, you know, making the food products that they sell healthier. And so, and Dave, you know, has a very small, dedicated group of people who report to him. It's more of spreading influence to the organization. And so I think one of the key aspects, and Dave's a leader in this, is that sustainability is a discipline that everybody has. It's not a group or a department or a function. Sustainability is part of product development and finance and cost accounting, and part of, you know, environmental responsibility and health and safety and manufacturing and supply chain. And so I think that's, you know, it's what the HIP scorecard provides is an easy, intuitive way to think and act comprehensively that companies can use to measure and manage their performance, and that they can actually use as a tool to compare against their competitors and maintain their competitive lead or catch up in a highly competitive environment.
You've been involved in helping Walmart develop its scorecard. Did your experience working with them change the way that you measure and evaluate sustainability or work with subsequent companies?
Sure. Yeah, so most of the work that we've done with Walmart, which we were part of a larger team with Blue Sky Consulting and Environmental Defense Fund and some nonprofits, as well as suppliers and staff, we you know, helped co-create a sustainability index for, you know, mainly to apply to other suppliers, but that over time is intended to be part of a product rating system and product labeling system that customers can use, you know, when they walk into a store. And so, you know, in that process, we introduced the HIP scorecard and categories, and there were other methodologies that Walmart evaluated. And so for Walmart in particular, they chose, you know, four main categories as part of their drive to, you know, what's thought of as what's described as save money, live better. And three of those categories were environmental, around greenhouse gases, natural resources, reducing waste, natural resource efficiency. And the fourth is around sort of social and trust factors. And so, you know, what Walmart's doing with its 60,000 plus suppliers, and it's estimated that the total revenue of all of the companies who sell to Walmart, not just what they sell to Walmart directly, but the total sales, is about a third of global GDP. So the public service that Walmart's provided to the world is by shifting its supply chain, and any company can do this, and it actually could be a simpler way for companies to make progress, is to kind of turn up the accountability on their supply chain to provide products. If you're a retailer, provide better products and services on your shelves, which is one of Walmart's goals and drive, or to change the inputs to your products and services that then you sell to customers. And so Walmart's been rolling out the sustainability scorecard and index across its supply chain around the world, including China. And it's now shifted into an industry-wide consortium. So if you go to sustainabilityconsortium.org, you will find five retailers, not just Walmart, but include Safeway. You'll find a couple dozen product and manufacturing companies, including Procter & Gamble and Colgate-Palmolive. And you'll find academics and academic research actually contributing to a product lifecycle analysis that will lead to the ultimate rating and ranking of these products. And that will be a really helpful signal for customers shopping on the shelves. So a company that's doing this already is Hannaford Brothers, which is a retail grocery in the Northeast United States. And they have a 3-star, 2-star, 1-star, 0-star system on the health and wellness of the products in the store. And so the opportunity has basically been converted by showing that customers increase their purchases by the market share of those products that have a 3-star rating have gone up 5 to 10%, and the ones that have a 0-star rating have actually lost market share.
Wow.
So customers are looking for products that are better for them from a health or wealth, or we say earth or quality and trust perspective, and that the financials follow, the revenue growth and the profit growth and the shareholder value continue. So Walmart, and now P&G has just released an open source supplier scorecard as well last week. And, you know, so it's really, Walmart's really done something quite powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And they have support internally, which they've been doing through their personal sustainability program that Adam Warbach helped them pioneer through the consulting that they get through Blue Sky Consulting, but also through and the leadership of people like Rand Woodups and Matt Kissler, but also from the board leadership. And so Rob Walton, who's the son of the founder Sam Walton, is not only, you know, a big advocate of sustainability, he's also one of the major investors in First Solar, a public solar panel company in Arizona. So this is, you know, this is serious business, and Walmart even adapted its outgoing marketing to not only save money, but also to live better. And they realize now that there's a, you know, more comprehensively, that there's a full life cycle cost to everything that they do, and that's getting built into their decision systems, including into the compensation and performance measures that their buyers have. So the buyers are getting rated on what proportion of products are more sustainable.
It's really interesting. I had one question, and then your last a couple of comments ago, it raised another. Do you think with these different companies like Hanover Brothers or P&G or having their own rating systems with different stars, does that somehow need to be standardized for customers to trust it? Do you think there'll be initial uptick in trust and then kind of a drop-off as how do I compare this 3-star rating, what does it really mean with this company's rating?
So that's a great point, Olivia, and there will need to be greater standardization over time, and that has not happened yet. Earlier this year, the SEC has encouraged companies to start disclosing as a material risk their carbon exposure and environmental exposure, and but that is not a mandate, it's only encouragement. The Carbon Disclosure Project has, you know, helped to standardize that with companies voluntarily reporting. You know, and there have been other stabs at a methodology to do that. We think the HIP scorecard is one that helps to provide some standardization and to do so on a results basis and to also be a management system for the company that can improve their performance and also be a, you know, a way to evaluate your investment portfolio. At some point, though, you know, these will need to link more closely together so that we don't end up with a VHS versus beta or kilometers versus miles conversion system and that we can actually, you know, standardize, synthesize, and roll up the results of a of impact accounting. But, you know, today we have, you know, more than 100 years of financial accounting experience. You know, we only have, you know, a decade or two of impact accounting, and that's mainly in, you know, the UN Human Development Index or some other early stage methodologies. So I think we'll see that evolve over the coming years and decades.
So my other question was, do you see companies, I mean, I was thinking of the HIP 100 scorecard as an internal tool for companies, but are you seeing companies now who are scoring well on it wanting to use that as a publicity tool, a marketing tool, a public reflection of their work? And are you helping to promote, I mean, is that something that you want to promote?
Yeah, I mean, we'd love for companies to lay the HIP approach in their annual reports or, you know, in other ways to describe and synthesize their success, you know, or for investors, you know, let's say, you know, on Morningstar, you could see, you know, what the HIP score, or Barron's, you could see what the HIP score of a mutual fund or ETF would be. So, you know, again, I think that will happen over time. When you go to the Wall Street Journal today, you know, you find financial data and metrics and information. You don't find impact data and metrics and information. Bloomberg is starting to do that by integrating Carbon Disclosure Project data in the Bloomberg screens and doing comparisons around that. There's other data sources out there like FF4 that do that for a fee. There's a real opportunity to connect with customers, employees, and investors in a way where customers can vote with their dollars for products that they see as healthier. One of the challenges in environmental labeling, if you go to ecolabeling.org, you'll see there's more than 275 environmental labels in the world, across China, Europe, America, for different industries. So there's definitely a proliferation there. So it's not just the Good Housekeeping Seal anymore. It's, Forest Stewardship Council, Marine Stewardship Council, and the like. In terms of, who are companies that are pioneering this, we mentioned Infosys earlier, global technology company based in India. Now Tata, another global company based in India, is copying them. It's really, for some of the more compelling reporters, Shell, if you go to the Shell annual report, you'll see 10 years of data of environmental performance. They've worked with nonprofits to help make that more specific. GE blends sustainability and citizenship data into its annual report and business information into its citizenship report. It's really helpful to go and not just look at the corporate social responsibility web pages. It's really telling when you go to the annual report or business report and look it up. And the serious companies are able to, convey their how sustainability drives profitability, and the not so serious companies show you lots of photos and anecdotes. And and that's a way you can do your own research by what you buy, where you work, and how you invest.
Let me just confirm what you said, because I've never heard that before. I've never thought about it that way. But you're saying to really look at companies who are using sustainability to drive profitability, that we would find evidence of that in the annual report rather than their sustainability or CSR materials.
The ones who are the most serious are blending them together. And you'll see that in P&G and Intel and GE. You'll see it in other top 10 companies like Pepsi's Performance with Purpose, Nike, Cisco, the serious companies. Campbell Soup is making presentations to traditional Wall Street analysts on the sodium content of its revenue mix. These are the leaders and true forward thinkers of our economy, and big companies are doing it. It's also the case where small companies are doing it and pushing that forward, but the big companies have the scale. So a company like Hewlett-Packard, which is being very innovative and aggressive and uses scorecards around sustainability, the one business unit within Hewlett-Packard, exceeds, several companies' size. So if, like we described with Walmart, you can make a pretty systematic decision, let's say on supply chain, you can ripple it through. Each company has a supply chain that they can apply it to. And the more they're, externally descriptive of it to traditional audiences, which include the annual report to investors, the more serious the company is.
What are the companies?
And we find that the ones who do that, end up having a financial outperformance from a portfolio basis.
One of the companies that you talked about in the book was United Technologies, and you talked about, and they sell Otis elevators and jet engines. And when they started publicizing their HIP products like eco-efficient buses or zero energy building design, their stock price moved up beyond the industry average. Can you talk about why this happened? Was it public perception? Was it consumer need?
Yeah, it's a combination of all of the above. And so obviously customers, for the revenue of a company to go up, customers have to make a new decision. And many corporations, as well as governments, are shifting their buying criteria to include environmental and social aspects of what they buy. So that's happening today. Employees get more excited about working in those companies and those business units. In the United Technologies example, it's a conglomerate. So sometimes it's hard to unpack what the value of the conglomerate is when you have things ranging from elevators to jet engines. One of the ways that United Technologies helped to increase the awareness of the inherent value of what they do, and United Technologies has a lot of HIP, positive HIP results, so any employee can go and get a graduate degree, and the company will help to finance it. They're very engineering driven, so they know what their natural resource waste and water efficiency ratios are. So what United Technologies did was to make sure that investors, and really institutional investors and analysts, and so how they put that together was to put a campaign that described what they were doing and target that to the business community and the investment community. And when that investor awareness was raised, then that led more people to understand that there's an opportunity that they may not want to pass up, and that helped boost their stock price relative to competitors. On that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Paul, you've already done work with Walmart, which is, you mentioned, of course, has a huge impact. Is there another company that you would really love to work with where you feel that you can really have an impact?
Well, you know, we're open to working with lots of companies. We think every company can succeed and make tremendous progress. You know, I'll give you an extreme example of, let's say, a company like Philip Morris. Philip Morris makes cigarettes, and cigarettes are not positive for your health. But cigarettes fill a customer need. And, you know, it's interesting that when you think of why do people smoke, why they continue smoking when it's addictive, but why do they start smoking in the first place? You know, some people smoke because they need to lose weight, and smoking actually helps supplant your, desire to eat more. Some people smoke to be to lower their stress, so they might be having a stressful day at work or school. And they do that. And, you know, some people smoke to be part of a community and to be included. And so when you ask Philip Morris what business they're in, they actually say, we're in the business of producing tobacco. And they declare that their corporate social responsibility is to help tobacco farmers make more money. Now, while that's positive and helps provide jobs and income streams, the reality is that the product that they make, tobacco and cigarettes, is not healthy. Negatively impacts people's health and even leads to death, and that they're produced in a way that has a toxic environmental stream, and that many times disproportionately affects people of lower income. Now, Philip Morris could choose to be in a business that solves a human need, and so if you think about losing weight, being part of a community, lowering your stress, they could establish some pilots to, you know, say, work with companies like Starbucks or Jenny Craig, or yoga studios, let's say, just to be really radical, because they're out to solve that human need that was not reliant on an addictive product. So that would be a truly radical shift at the highest levels of the company of how to solve a human need, not through the product that they inherited, but through how does this, you know, provide, create a better world where customers are better off from using their product after than before. In my consulting work at McKinsey and CSC, I've worked with companies across all different industries. But the one I think that needs a radical transformation is the financial services industry. And that's why we are an investment advisor. And what we're trying to show is, one, that you can be open and transparent and open source, like we are with the HIP Investor Book, where we showcase 3/4 of the methodology, and that means other financial institutions can copy it. And that's okay with us, because we want to spread, you know, HIP through all $175 trillion worth of global capital markets. And two is that there aren't enough products today that deliver both human impact and profit. And that we want to boost the proportion of products in U.S. equities, international equities, fixed income, as well as other asset classes, so that all investors, you know, have the opportunity, if they choose, to pursue a HIP portfolio. Today, that range of products does not yet exist. So, we're definitely open to working with financial service companies who want to create a family of mutual funds or ETFs, or who would like to roll that out for their private clients, or venture capital or private equity, so that there are more investment pools and funds that can have a HIP approach. We're open and willing to work with any company who wants to be more HIP, and what we love about our clients, whether they're companies or investors, is, you know, they see that they can be 100% HIP, and that's why, you know, they choose to work with us.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I really do recommend your book, which is, it just serves as, it's a great guide for creating businesses and also investment portfolios, of course, that are profitable and good for society. Paul, I have one more question, which is a little out of left field perhaps, but in your book dedication, you dedicated to only women, to specific women, but only women. Why is that? I thought that was interesting.
Well, I actually dedicate it to all the strong women of the world and the high esteemed men who respect them. So I actually dedicate it to men and women, but I'm very specific about that because I believe that we have a lot of talent in our world that hasn't yet been given the opportunity to reach its full potential. And that whether that be, you know, equal access for schools for girls as well as boys across the world, or encouragement of following your own journey and career path among, you know, young ladies as well as young men, or that, you know, create equal access and proportion of, you know, board and executive teams, which comprise both men and women. You know, Nicholas Kristof wrote a column during the crisis that said, would Lehman Brothers have failed if it were called Lehman Sisters? And there's data to show that hedge fund managers, women hedge fund managers, outperform male hedge fund managers over both the 10-year period as well as during the 2008 volatility. So there's, you know, and it's not just gender, it's ethnicity and income, and in some places around the world, caste or religion. By being, you know, a great species, the human species, we don't give all the member, you know, global community of 7 billion people the chance to be their best. I wanted to facilitate a shift in how everybody thought about it, and also thank the, you know, strong women who helped me develop to my fullest potential, make sure that, you know, everybody gives the strong women in their life, whether it be their mothers or sisters or wives or partners, you know, or family, the true opportunity to be your best and unleash what I think is a core human value, which is to deliver, you know, more human impact as well as profit. So it's important to me, and I wanted to share that through the HIP Investor book.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad that I asked then. Is there anything else that you want to add before we wrap up today?
Yeah, I'm just really excited, Olivia, that, you know, the community of people that are interested in cause capitalism, you know, are looking for ways to not just think this way, but to act this way. And that each of us have the ability, you know, every day in what we buy, where we work, and how we invest, to build a better world and to make it more hip. I'm delighted that we can, you know, introduce this, have a conversation about it, and continue the conversation about it, and, you know, look forward to feedback anybody has about the HIP Investor book or HIP scorecard or how HIP fits with your life and portfolio.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Paul.
For more interviews about cause capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.